Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Once more, the human world awaits the prospect of war with bated breath, as it has so often beyond memory. Humanity's inhumane horrors front-lobed in the universal brain. Vladimir Putin, the new millennium Tsar pretender of post-communist Russia, who appears to oscillate between Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great, with a sheen of Stalin lumped in as glue, suddenly chokeholds most of the Western alliance in a hostage situation, threatening breakaway Republic Ukraine with blood-soaked kidnapping if it is allowed to join NATO, the Cold War-instigated affiliation of Western Europe and the USA, contraposed to Bolshevist Marxism. Putin might even consider himself the biblical shepherd retrieving a strayed lamb. He is threatening war to retrieve a relatively newly established sovereign nation that no longer desires union with Russia. He is what George Orwell tried to tell us about dictators and their wolfishly predatory ambitions in his novel 1984, and which G.G. Colton called the avarice of power. This is what dictators do, and Orwell so eloquently warned about. They make incessant war and suborn their subjugated populations to war upon and enslave or destroy other populations. Perhaps the most extreme example was the core bloodbath of World War II, in which the impressed armies of dictators Hitler and Stalin fought the most titanic battles of history against each other for nearly 4 years. The Russians alone lost 20 million dead, civilian and military. We really do not need a new age of dictators, such as our late 20th century predecessors experienced. Most of us recognize we need a unity of our species to combat threats of extinction from two horrors of our own concoction: nuclear holocaust, which might conceivably escalate from the current war scare, and our beleaguered home planet we are rapidly making hostile to our continued inhabitants by our own ill-conceived invention. Instead, despotic fascism that nearly obliterated humanity last time is re-arising all over the world at the onset of this new millennium, setting us at each other's throats once more. And we Americans, the self-promoted avatars of democracy and human rights, have recently discovered how frail our own claim to democratic integrity actually is. The World Court should be activated at the very least, and charges of intent to commit genocide be brought against Putin, if for no other purpose than to attempt derailing this new millennium's surge toward universal despotism. Humanity is already in great trouble from its careless and callous treatment of Mother Gaia without this ancient menace of Orwellian despotism and interminable warfare, which will obviously and dreadfully hasten the sixth extinction. And that was something I wrote. And now, this is the final week of Black History Month, and I'd like to read something I wrote, and I believe I've read it in a longer form on this program before. American carnage is not just breeding. The story of the United States is a struggle between white and black, which was at the core of the Civil War a century and a half ago. The fourth century genocide against Native Americans is a third leg of the racial triangle. Intense resistance against institutional racism is necessary if the nation as a whole is to resolve the bitter enmity between American blacks and whites A few years ago, a television personality gaffed himself in an interview with a reporter from a gay magazine who quoted him as saying, "Most people are born with equal intelligence, but blacks have watered down their genes because the less intelligent ones are the ones that have the most children." A subsequent imbroglio caused by this champion of breeding, only by people of breeding aside, he pointed out an increasing problem about the world population explosion. Humanity is more prolific than rats, almost. As Abraham Lincoln said, God must love poor people because he made so many of them. Most of the world's children are poor and hungry with little chance of education or sustaining employment. It is myopic as well as deceptive to attribute the problem of breeding solely to the people begetting the children. After all, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, black, white, etc., humanity's single, compelling, and insensate purpose is to breed, to instinctively and virtually mindlessly perpetuate the species, whether it is a good idea or not. The implication is that intelligent folk are losing genetic headway because they aren't multiplying as rapidly as mentally deficient folk. Yet, given that for millions of years, adolescence has been the prime breeding time for human beings, despite modern society's disapproval, perhaps an unwed teenage mother from the inner city has a better chance of producing healthier stock than upscale 30-somethings who established careers before children. The idea that the least fit are proliferating does not probe the circumstances that might qualify some people less fit to reproduce than others. And if it does indeed target blacks, it is actually on the mark, though for quite opposite reasons than implied. Impoverishment, malnutrition, chronic unemployment, lack of education, or opportunity for education are major factors toward dissolving the potency of a community, a nation, a race. They are not the result of inferior genes, but of defective social and political policies that might rightfully, though cautiously, be called genocide. Blacks in America have always been a suppressed people, slaves or free. Their arduous, tragic, and unequal role in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Yet the black struggle for civic and social equality, particularly in the civil rights movement, has been the most inspiring and closest to the revolution of enlightenment that gave birth to this nation than any other. This is a struggle our revered white revolutionary ancestors started, but denied people of color, who were regarded as property rather than persons born equal and certainly not born free. The renewed and vengeful backlash of prejudice and oppression against American blacks for having dared challenge white supremacy is revealed as more insidious than mere colonialism or neo-apartheid if it is realized that an underlying intent is for them to indeed breed themselves into helpless oblivion without any means of support for survival, and in turn dissolve the will and capacity for them to continue as a people as well as persons. Before Sartre branded the U.S. war against Vietnam as genocide, he cautioned that the word must be used sparingly and precisely, or it loses its meaning and power, which it has partially because Sartre freed its use. Genocide is defined as the deliberate and systematic destruction of a racial, cultural, or political group. Genocide can be overtly applied through war or by establishing death camps. It can also be carried out more subtly over a long period through political and social attrition. One of Voltaire's friends, said there would never be justice, equality, or freedom in the world until the last king was strangled with the intestines of the last priest. He might have included dispatching racial supremacists. Not only do they cause much of the world's troubles, they also substantiate the general theory of genetic defectiveness. Skinheads, as a friend of mine says, have more hair than brains. And now, by Esau Macaulay, Black History Month is about seeing America clearly. Growing up, I didn't know anyone who did the kinds of jobs featured at career fairs or depicted on television shows. I had never met a Black doctor, lawyer, professor, or scientist. Where does a young Black man go when looking for hope? My teachers, overworked as they were, pointed me toward Black luminaries from the past. The first Black History Month project I recall was about George Washington Carver. I was enthralled with the idea that the early 20th century agricultural scientist, born into slavery, came up with hundreds of uses for peanuts. By the time Black History Month rolled into full swing, my ode to the master of peanuts sat alongside posters lauding the accomplishments of such stalwarts as Martin Luther King Jr. He always inspired multiple posters. Rosa Parks, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, and Sojourner Truth. Black history in this frame is the story of exemplars. We learn about the first Black surgeon, Supreme Court justice, or astronaut. This version of Black history endeavors to show Black capability and challenge stereotypes. The lesson is clear. If this Black person from history overcame racism, so could we. With enough grit, determination, and patience, we too could go to space or invent hundreds of uses for a common crop. These exemplars were helpful, but the exercise also left me with the feeling that there was a long list of things Black people had never done, and my job was to find one of those things and check it off the list. Then we could stand before the world and say, we have done all the things. Can we have justice now? This exemplar-based approach to Black history also produced an unintentional consequence. It gave those outside our community license to use Black accomplishment against us. They told us that we needed more exceptional Black people instead of questioning a society that required such greatness of us. Our very victories were transfigured into condemnations of those still languishing. I was exposed to a second form of Black History Month when I got older, Black history as corrective. In this version, we learned about Black achievement that had been erased from the historical record. It points us to the African-American female mathematicians involved in the space race, as recounted fictionally in the film Hidden Figures, or the Tuskegee Airmen, whose contributions during World War II were long underappreciated. This is important. One reason that we are still chasing firsts is because too many of our accomplishments have been stolen from us. But the problem is that this way of teaching history is about amending a story instead of telling a more truthful one. It was not until I got to college that I began to see African American history for what it truly is. It is not a series of heroics or forgotten contributions. It is a different telling of the American story altogether. What happens when we do not begin with the Mayflower, but the slave ship, and tell American history from that perspective? The explicit aim of the 1619 Project, quote unquote, was to reframe the country's history by placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of our national narrative. This powerful, challenging idea led to a still raging debate about racism in America that is playing out in school boards and local elections all over the country, with certain books and ideas being ruled out of bounds. Americans have not been taught enough about anti-black racism in our past and present. This, to my mind, is beyond dispute. We are poor as a nation for these omissions. It is also true that scholars of goodwill can disagree when making sense of the lives of figures long dead. People are complex, and getting at the complexity is no small thing. Education should be a place where such matters are debated openly. But endless discussions about the intent of the Founding Fathers miss a fundamental point. History is not merely the study of intent. It encompasses effect. Whether or not every Founding Father intended to create a government that sanctioned slavocracy and later Jim Crow, those were the outcomes. To limit the question to the intent at the expense of the experience of the enslaved and their descendants is to prioritize white American intentions or ideals over black bodies, a mistake our republic has made over and over. What cannot be doubted is that for African peoples brought to this land against our will, slavery and anti-black racism are defining characteristics of our American experience. This is why Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech draws upon the Declaration of Independence in its opening moment. He highlighted the fact that this declaration had little purchase in the lives of black folk. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. Black history should be a challenge to our republic and its core narrative. Instead of quibbling with this detail or that, it must raise a fundamental question about the quality of life black people have been allowed to experience. If we are indeed a part of this nation, then our lives and experiences have a claim on our national narrative. African American history forces us to view the black experience of injustice, not as the interruption of or caveat to an otherwise grand narrative, but as a compelling story in its own right. Would this leave us with only a tale of woe? No. There is a dark beauty to the American story. The beauty is not in our innocence. We have been party to too much death and terror for that. African American history requires the recasting of our central figures, where those on the sidelines are brought to the forefront. The enslaved must be allowed to unbend their backs and step into the light and claim the glory due to them. Washington and Lincoln must give way to Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass as American marvels. What makes America a wonder is that this is the land upon which my ancestors, despite the odds, fought for and often made a life for themselves. We are great because this land housed the poetry of Phyllis Wheatley and Maya Angelou, the advocacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, the urgency of Nina Simone's music, and the faith-inspired demand for change in Martin Luther King Jr.'s sermons. This way of telling the story allows us to speak of American ideals, even if the norm is failure rather than accomplishment. It allows our history to chronicle progress without diminishing the suffering necessary to bring it about. This means, too, that to tell the American story well, the contributions of us black folks cannot be limited to February. Black history offers America a chance to see itself both as what we have failed to become and as we wish ourselves to be. It is not to inspire hate for one race or to foment division. America, seeing itself clearly, is the first step toward owning and then learning from its mistakes. The second step is the long journey to become that which we hope to be, a more perfect and just union. And that was by Esau Macaulay. Black History Month is about seeing America clearly. He wrote that for the New York Times. And now, a poem by the late Carolyn Dunn. These Things. Daytime is when the world pushes its things around. The cable trucks arrive and propel one of their people up and over, under and through the branches of a huge tree. The man in harness up there, playing out stretches of wire, his superiors circling the area, shouting orders, pulling cable, keeping an eye out for traffic, while overhead, crows and gulls rise in a gyre of indignation, and far above them, the first Coast Guard helicopter of the day heads west to practice its maneuvers in order to save the inevitable someone, sometime, under and through, up and out of the sea. Inside, people boot up computers, fill out forms, push papers in front of people, plug in vacuum cleaners, make phone calls to order sandwiches for the lunch seminar, make sandwiches, calm two children in a fight over the ownership of a ball, take an old person's pulse, or freshen their glass of water, wonder what and why, check their watches, keep moving, study documentation, nurse a headache, come out the other end of the tunnel, go home. At night, none of this. We pretty much leave things alone at night. Not everybody. Mostly the ones who, in the middle of their lives, are paid to push around our palpable world so all of us can do the constant, curious, prying our kind is programmed to do, and which gets us into all the wants and fixes we get into, and which demands an endless, able-bodied crew to provide and extricate us from these things. And this is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. And now, the only four important questions to ask human beings, according to a source that I have forgotten. 1, how do you fill up your time? 2, how do you feel about how you fill up your time? 3, what do you love? 4, how do you react to those you perceive as either superior or inferior to you? The seemingly never-ending plague ravaging humanity, in a sense, completes a triad of human fallibilities. War, plague, and ecocide. A toxic swirl like a song children sang during the Black Death of several centuries ago. Ring around the rosy. All fall down. Now is no time to succumb to surrender. The vernal equinox is only a month away, and we can all ring around the rosies and not fall back.